From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More U.S. and NATO troops are being sent to Russia's borders. The Wall Street Journal reported Wednesday that yet another 4,000 U.S. and NATO troops will be deployed to the Baltic states and Poland. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
The Wall Street Journal says under one plan, the Western Military Alliance would have a battalion in Poland and each of the three Baltic states. Another plan includes only a single NATO battalion in the area. The move is aimed at what NATO calls deterring aggression from Moscow. Meanwhile, despite U.S. support for the plan, German officials have expressed reservations. Berlin has made it clear that it does not want to treat Moscow as a permanent enemy or lock it out of Europe. NATO accuses Russia of meddling in Ukraine's internal affairs. Moscow, though, denies any involvement.
The U.S. is also upping tensions in the Pacific, as we've reported earlier. Press TV's Ali Rashidi has more.
Despite China's strong condemnation, the U.S. says it will continue to send warships to patrol in the disputed area in the South China Sea. This is specifically about the area close to the artificial islands built by China. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter confirmed that the U.S. Navy has patrolled within 12 nautical miles of at least one of the islands.
We have said, and we are acting on the basis of saying, that we will fly, sail, and operate wherever international law permits.
Did we send a destroyer yesterday inside the 12-mile zone of one of the...
To do that, there have been naval operations in that region in recent days, and there will be in the weeks and months.
Based on the UN law of the sea, the area within 12 nautical miles from the baseline of a nation is regarded as the sovereign territory of the state. However, foreign ships, both military and civilian, are allowed innocent passage through it. Apparently, China does not believe the patrolling by U.S. warships, accompanied by the Pentagon's most advanced spy plane, is an example of innocent passage, especially since the area is disputed between China and some of the neighboring countries. Beijing has called the U.S. move irresponsible and warned that such actions would damage Chinese-U.S. relations. China has also summoned the American ambassador to Beijing to protest over the issue. The two sides are accusing one another of militarizing the region. Political analyst Mike Billington believes the U.S. is the one that is militarizing the region, and it does it intentionally.
You now have Obama saying that China is being aggressive and militarizing the South China Sea, which, if they were, would be their right, given that it's their territory, their border. And yet here we are sending warships in an open provocation, which cannot be interpreted by anybody in the world other than an intent to provoke a confrontation with Russia. And this has happened, with China. And Russia, for that matter.
Some observers believe that though the war of words has intensified between China and the U.S., a physical confrontation is not likely to happen. Washington suspected that Beijing might be trying to build up its outposts to extend its military reach. On the other hand, the Chinese see the U.S. patrols as being aimed at keeping and improving Washington's influence and military dominance in the region. The U.S. military built-up in the region has caused anger in regional countries. People in those countries, such as Japan and South Korea, have held rallies to protest Washington's military presence in the region. Given the U.S. insistence on keeping troops in Southeast Asia, there's no end in sight to tensions in the region.
Could former British Prime Minister Tony Blair and former U.S. President George W. Bush find themselves together in the dock facing war crimes charges over their war on Iraq? Press TV's Sharon Arfai reports.
Former British Prime Minister Tony Blair has apologized for, quote, the mistakes made in the Iraq war and the role that it's played in the emergence of ISIL. He, however, stopped short of an apology for the invasion itself.
You know, whenever I'm asked this, I can say that I apologize for the fact that the intelligence we received was wrong. Because even though he had used chemical weapons extensively against his own people, against others, the program in the form that we thought it was, did not exist.
Blair stands accused of once again lying about why he decided to join former U.S. President George W. Bush in the war on Iraq. He said wrong intelligence led to the decision to go to war, while many observers, both Western and non-Western, believe he had already made up his mind to ally himself with Bush. The then British intelligence apparatus fabricated what was at the time called the Iraq dossier, which alleged that Iraq was trying to buy fissile material from Niger in an attempt to make nukes. The dossier later turned out to be fake. The apology is the latest chapter for an issue which has dogged Blair since 2003, when the UK alongside the US invaded Iraq with the stated aim of establishing a democracy after toppling former dictator Saddam Hussein.
Saddam Hussein's regime was bloody to the Iraqi people and toppling it was a favor. But after that, what did they offer? A lot of chaos and more destruction. We didn't see a real intention to build the state. We didn't see a beneficial cooperation from the British side to the Iraqi people.
They admitted after toppling of the regime that we didn't find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. That was the excuse he used then. And now he appears in public and apologizes about what happened to the Iraqi people and about the destruction and says, we are not supporting Daesh. No. But you are supporting Daesh and all the other calamities before that, like Zarqawi and bin Laden. All these are American and British acts.
Blair, along with Bush, made himself one of the most notorious contemporary political leaders by his decision to take part in the Iraq War. He's been grilled on a number of occasions, but in all inquiries, he defiantly defended the invasion.
Excuse me, this man should be arrested for war crimes. J.P. Morgan paid him off for the Iraq war after he left office. The man is a war criminal!
There have been numerous protests against the former British Prime Minister's role in the Iraq war, with the demonstrators calling for his trial for war crimes. The Iraq war is said to have left hundreds of thousands of Iraqis dead and the country's infrastructure in ruins. British troops have been accused of committing crimes against the Iraqi people in the course of the war. Many believe that the most disastrous outcome of the Iraq war was that it spawned numerous terrorist groups in the Middle East. The occupied Iraq became a magnet for the terrorists flocking to the region from all over the world. And there's no end in sight to the wave of terrorism which has been ravaging the region since 2003.
Jim Brann with the Stop the War Coalition in London, speaking with Press TV's Marzia Hashemi, pointed out that the record of criminal intent is clear and unambiguous.
We don't have to guess or speculate. We know that, for example, by the famous Downing Street memo, it's all laid out there. You can just read out the memo. It's very clear that United States was going ahead with the war, whatever. It didn't matter what the weapons inspectors found. It didn't matter what the United Nations Security Council would say. United States was going ahead. That's what it said in the Downing Street memo. And it was very clear that the British government was going along with it. And that was British policy, if you like, to go along with the United States. It's as simple as that. One thing I think has to be said very clearly. When Blair said he apologizes for the intelligence that was wrong, that is simply a brazen lie. There was no intelligence. And you can show that when there were newspaper reports saying that there was no intelligence that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And we now have the documentation. It's not a matter of guesswork. You fast forward to the dossier that you referred to, and there's nothing in it to justify Blair's statement on page one of the dossier of September 2002, saying that Iraq was developing nuclear, chemical, biological weapons.
Well, shouldn't Blair then have to at least, Mr. Brann, shouldn't Blair have to at least face a British court, if not the ICC?
Yes, I mean, there's a whole history to that, but in 2006, it came to what is now called the Supreme Court of the United Kingdom. They adjudicated that, yes, there was a perfectly arguable case that the United Kingdom, alongside the United States, had committed the crime of aggression, that the crime of aggression was the supreme international crime according to the Nuremberg judgment, but they said no specific law had been passed in Britain outlawing the crime of aggression. And I would point out that in the German constitution and in the Japanese constitution following the Second World War, that prohibition was built into the constitution, as it was to some extent in the Italian constitution. So the countries that lost the Second World War actually have that in some form, that prohibition, in their constitutions, whereas Britain and the United States, which won the Second World War, but which still signed up to the United Nations Charter, have no law implementing that prohibition on the crime of aggression. And that's fundamentally why Blair can get away with it.
On Saturday, November 7th, the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace and Reparations will hold its annual rally and march on the White House, followed the next day by a conference at Howard University. The coalition is demanding black community control of the police and will march under the banner Black Power Matters. But according to Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford, there's been no real discussion of the meaning of black power in many years. He spoke with Black Is Back chairman Omali Yeshitila.
I think that we are at a really important point in history because, if you remember, Glenn, even in the 1960s, after the Black Power slogan was thrust out into the world and that excited and electrified a lot of Africans and other people around the world, there still was a struggle happening within the movement of what Black Power means. But that struggle did not actually realize itself sufficiently because the government murdered and destroyed people who were advocating black power, advocating self-determination for African people, including Malcolm, the members of the Black Panther Party, etc., before the struggle actually satisfied itself. And so we've had this dry spell for more than two generations after this happened, because in its place, we have seen that people who were opposed to black power, however it's defined, people who were opposed to self-determination, I'm talking about in our own communities, who saw themselves seeing their future tied to imperialism, tied to the very same social system and actual arrangement that oppresses us all, those people have been thrust into prominence as a consequence of the destruction of the Black Revolution, the Black Power Movement, and those of us who stood for that. So that is the thing that happened to us then, and it's been a very difficult dry spell for more than two generations. And then, after all the killings and all the horrible things that's been happening to us that had just beaten the people down and all the charlatans being able to mislead the people and keep us off track, we saw on August 9, 2014, after this man Darren Wilson, dressed in a police uniform, killed Mike Brown, in this explosion of resistance that was sustained long enough, in fact, it's actually going on even as we have this discussion, that it forced the world to be able to see what was the conditions that Africans are suffering from, and it thrust upon the agenda of black people ourselves the whole question of what blackness means, what our connection to Africa is, what is struggle, and you got now people who have not had any association with the black revolution or anti-imperialism struggle in our community, and who just a little more than a year ago would not even entertain the discussion. We can't shut them up because the whole African community in this country has been excited and consciousness driven through the roof as a consequence of the resistance stemming from Ferguson. So it's a new era now, and we're all involved in trying to give some kind of leadership and direction to it. But we're in a contest today with the very same forces we were contending with after the destruction of our movement. And a lot of people would misdirect the struggle, would misinform the struggle, would distort the history of our whole movement to convince people that the only thing we really want is to be accepted by white people and to be loved by America.
So when one says black power matters, it's really a discussion about black self-determination.
It is a discussion about black self-determination. It's not even an attempt at this point to say what that looks like, but it does say that it's got to be about self-determination, that if we want people to stop killing us, that what we have to do is have the power ourselves to stop it, that we have to drive a movement in the direction of black people accepting responsibility for our own future. And so we say black power matters, and as it relates to the police, we say black community control of the police, and if we can ignite a movement, if we can drive a movement in the direction of demanding control of that arm of the state with which we have the closest, most ubiquitous kind of relationship, if we can put the idea of power on the brains of African people, something that happened in the 1960s, and when it happened in the 1960s, what it did was to place the struggle of black people in this country at one with the struggles of other people who were struggling for power, except they called it struggling against colonialism. Whether it's in Vietnam, whether it's in South Africa, any other place around the world, when that happened, it took the struggle of black people in this country out of this context of trying to reform America and make America better and somehow fitting into it, and it placed it in the context of the same struggle that people in Vietnam and Bolivia and all around the world were struggling for, and that is to have control of our own lives, to be, we were opposed to colonialism as it impacts on African people in this country.
In many demonstrations over the past year or so, we do see placards that say things like killer cops out of our community. But there is not a demand emanating from the Black Lives Matter movement or its Campaign Zero component for black community control of the police that would eradicate these killer cops from our community.
I think that's right, and I think a lot of work is being done. I don't think it's an accident that these demands are not being made. I had an opportunity to have a struggle with one of the leaders of the hashtag Black Lives Matter movement and raised this issue. It's not an accident. In fact, they were very emphatic, or he was, and Julius Jones, very emphatic about what they were about is changing the hearts of Hillary Clinton. And he said, we know that Hillary Clinton is probably going to be the next president of the United States, and the objective is to change her heart. And we said, well, Hillary Clinton herself is telling you that it's not about changing her heart. It's about policies. It's about what kind of demand that you have to make. And so it's not an accident. They're very clear on what they're doing. Any more is it an accident that someone would call for a justice or else march as opposed to saying what else? The whole notion that somehow you can go to Washington, D.C. to get justice, of course, is ridiculous. And most African people understood that. And so there were probably 1 million African people who went to Washington, D.C. knowing that there was no justice there, but hoping that there would be an or else there. They went there for or else. And of course, that was not delivered to them from the platform and from the people who called that mobilization. I think they're one and the same. This whole thing of obscuring what the real questions and issues are, they function as obscurantists. So that they don't identify, they don't create a target, they don't identify imperialism, they don't identify the Obama regime, they don't identify anything wrong with America. And it's like knowing that people want to run and thrusting them on treadmills so that they can run like hell and exhaust themselves but never get anywhere. So that's the kind of thing that I think we're faced with today, and that's why I think the coalition plays such an important role. And that's why I think that all the people, so many people were disgusted. Some people didn't go. And you think about this, there are possibly 1 million people there, and a lot of people who didn't go because they didn't expect anything from that process. And then a lot of people who went there were disgusted because there was, nothing came from it. So this is a call by the coalition to say that the people who went to Washington, D.C. looking for the or else, that you can find the or else with the mobilization that the Black is Black Coalition will be doing in Washington, D.C. when we have our rally at Malcolm X Park at noon, when we have our march from that rally site to the White House, and then on the 8th, the second day, when we have our conference to discuss some of these critical issues with no ambiguity about the else, but actually trying to lay out and define what's happening in the real world with a materialist perspective as opposed to some obscurantist or religions or superstitious take on what's happening in the world. The coalition, I think, is the appropriate response, and I think that increasingly more and more people will see that.
We saw that the Occupy movement dissolved into the presidential election of 2012. Is there the danger that the incipient movement that arose last year will dissolve in the presidential campaign of 2016?
The reason I don't think that will happen is because the Occupy movement, as important as it may have been, was different. Because here you have an African population that itself could have been absorbed by the Occupy movement, but now is coming to some kind of consciousness about its own condition, its own relationship to America. And this has been the driving force for progress in this country since Africans were kidnapped and brought here. And I like to remind people who were like these Obama supporters and who said that if we don't vote for Obama, then fascism is going to descend upon us, etc. Therefore, we have to support Obama, support the lesser imperialist evil. And I like to remind people that what it was that kept this proto-fascism from occurring in the United States was not a struggle against fascism, but it was a struggle that was led by people like Fannie Lou Hamer and Ella Baker and down in the South, who really are responsible for whatever has been defined as democracy in this country subsequent to that time. And the black liberation movement in this country getting its footing and black people coming to consciousness is different from stopping a worker struggle as it's recognized, generally speaking, in the factories or something like that. It's a people struggle. And I think the role of the coalition, that's the thing that makes us so important, is to continue to take that understanding out there. And I don't think this is going to go away. I think we will help it not go away. I think we have a responsibility to help it not go away. I think we are conscious that it cannot go away if we are ever going to win our freedom. This is a moment that I don't believe that we can lose. And we're not going to have the hundreds of thousands of people or anything like that that Farrakhan was able to bring to Washington, D.C. in October. But we are getting more and more critical forces, people who want to actually change and not just come out and be spectators, but who want to participate in transforming the world. So all those people who are interested in the what else is to be found in the coalition, and we are continuously calling on those people who are disgusted about a lost moment or what could have been a lost moment in October to come and recapture and complete this whole revolutionary process that was initiated most recently in the 1960s. I believe this is our time, and I believe that the coalition will make all the difference in the world.
What are the things that's missing in the current era, in the current incipient movement, in addition to coherent demands, is a position, a worldview regarding black folks here and people's struggles in the rest of the world?
And I think that's really important. And there are several things about that, which is one reason I appreciate the coalition so much is that virtually every conference that we have, we examine the world situation so that African people can contextualize ourselves in this overall world situation. And the world situation is one where our enemies are in a state of crisis because of resistance that's happening everywhere. That's one aspect of it. And that's a very important aspect of it, too, because Africans have an ability to sense a kind of isolation here and around the world, and that we don't seem to have friends and allies. It's not something that's easily or normally or naturally seen. But the other thing about that is in September, I had the opportunity to be in Moscow at an international conference called A Dialogue of Nations and the Struggle for Self-Determination. And that was attended by different groups and peoples from throughout the world, from Ukraine, where people are actually involved in armed struggle against a U.S.-imposed dictatorship that has been placed on them there, from Puerto Rico, from Hawaii, from the Western Sahara, from Ireland, from Italy, from Catalonia in Spain. And this important discussion happened, but we were in the middle of this discussion. And we were saying, this is what's happening with African people in the United States and in the world. And while we appreciate all of the sympathy that people have shown us about what's happening with Ferguson and subsequent to Ferguson, we need more than just well-wishing. We need for you to support our struggle for self-determination. We need you to support the demand for reparations. We need you to support the work that we're doing now to bring the United States before the United Nations for genocide, for defying the Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Genocide. We need for you to recognize the right of African people in the United States to actually engage in armed self-defense from colonialism and colonial terror that's being waged against us. We need for you to support our demand for the release of all African people from prison in this country, particularly the release of African political prisoners. This is what we want you to do. And I think that we have all these people now. We just had a discussion with comrades from Russia, the anti-globalization movement of Russia. And as a consequence of this connection we have them, they're quoting Malcolm X. They're talking about Martin Luther King. They're talking about the right for African people to have reparations in this country. The Irish are saying that they support our struggle for reparations. So increasingly what is happening is that the struggle for black people in this country is being put on the agenda internationally. And people can see that. And people are trying to find a way now, as a consequence of our participation, to unite with that. This is a whole new era where the struggle of our people is something that's taken away from some kind of domestic agenda that's controlled by Washington, D.C., and it's placed on the agenda with the peoples of the world who are struggling for freedom, who are struggling for self-determination, just as we are struggling for self-determination, and it ends the isolation of our struggle. So the whole world now has an ability to see us not just as victims in Ferguson, but as people who are actively engaged in trying to change the relationship that we have with U.S. imperialism and actively engaged in trying to develop relationships with other oppressed peoples around the world.
So when the Black is Back Coalition talks about Black Power Matters, we're not talking about a parochially based movement, but one that embraces and wants to be embraced by the world.
Indeed. And that, I think, is just the new dynamic. And so despite, you know, the loss, and we had horrible losses to our movement in the 60s, but not just us, you know that. I mean, in 1967, October, this month, 1967, after wounding Che Guevara, he was murdered by a U.S. CIA operative. I mean, Nkrumah was overthrown. Lumumba was killed by the United States. And in this country, scores of black activists were murdered by police organizations and the FBI, and so many of us thrown into prison. We don't even know the numbers who went to prison. So we suffered a real serious setback. But I believe that we are approaching a whole new era. And I've never seen this situation since the 1960s where so many of the African people in this country, not just activists, because there aren't really that many activists, not black nationalists as such, but just ordinary people who now are really interested in what can be done to free black people and who are prepared to entertain the discussion about the history of our oppression and what it's going to take to free us.
And much of that discussion will occur at Howard University the day after the march on November 7th.
And we've got some splendid forces who are going to be participating in that discussion. Some of them are known to your listeners, and certainly Margaret Kimberly, who is one of your editors, and the sister Marshall Coleman Adebayo will be one of the persons. And then we'll have Cam Howard out of Chicago, who is a reparations specialist, who will be speaking to us. Just an incredible array of people who will be presenting, and we're going to be examining some of the fundamental questions. Out of Ferguson, Missouri, Sister Herdosia Bentham will be talking to us about the campaign for the Africans Charged Genocide and getting people to sign up to that campaign. So there's going to be some great discussion and examination of our situation, but beyond that, moving to actual practice, the kind of stuff that we have to do to change stuff, so that we are asking people to come, and we are trying to encourage people to move beyond simply being information consumers and to participate in doing something. They don't even have to join our organizations, but they can go online and they can go to AfricansChargedGenocide.org and sign that petition, and they can share that. They don't have to join anything, but they can take out petitions and sign petitions demanding black community control of the police. We want to create thousands and thousands of people who demonstrate some kind of unity through practice, through signing a petition. That's a small thing that they can do with where it is that we're trying to go. And the weight of that solidarity can be translated into political power in the struggle that we're engaged in.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds. Don't you know, talking about a revolution, it sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about gonna rise up and get their share. Poor people gonna rise up and take what's theirs.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.